There we go. Welcome, everybody that's here today for our House Subcommittee on Higher Ed. Today is Thursday, April 7th. We're privileged today to have a wonderful informational hearing from our friends at the University of Oregon. We'll have a couple of three or four panels that'll be appearing before us just to give us an overview of their plans and their proposals and their hopes and dreams and all of the above. And we're looking forward to hearing that. Before we do that, however, we're going to have a brief work session on House Bill 3521, so I'm going to open that up right now. Committee, I believe you have in front of you dash two amendments to House Bill 3521. And I wonder, Rep. Dembro, would you be willing just to kind of give us a little chronology of how we arrived here and what the purpose is behind the dash two?
Sure. So, colleagues, you remember we had a hearing last week, the week before, on 3521. That's the program. It's the bill that would create the transfer student bill of rights and responsibilities. And we, you know, it's a bill that I was working with the community colleges and OUS and Oregon Student Association to come up with a way of increasing our college completion rate, making it easier for students to transfer from community college to university or from community college to community college or from university to university, and to allow students who left the community college with enough credits to qualify for an associate's degree to make it easier for them to get that associate's degree, to remove some administrative impediments for that to happen. And if they leave the community college and go to the university before they have a degree, to allow them to wrap back the credits that they earn at the university and get that associate's degree. Because remember, the problem that many students face is they transfer and intend to get a baccalaureate degree within 4 years, and then 5 years come, 6 years come, you know, life has happened, and they find themselves with no degree. So that was the purpose behind the bill. What we found, you'll remember when we had the hearing, was that to go ahead and create the Bill of Rights and Responsibilities at this point would be premature, because one of the elements in it is having the computer tracking system in place that would make this, if not automatic, you know, closer to automatic, and students would have, you know, a much clearer sense of where they stood in terms of their credits. And there needed to be some further conversations between the community college system and OUS about how such a set of rights and responsibilities should be framed. So what they asked us to do was to rewrite this, to have amendments drafted that would put into place the effort to create this student Bill of Rights and Responsibilities, and that's what these amendments do. It has the work being done during the interim over the next 2 years, so that a final report would be created in the fall of 2012 in time for to make it fully operational after the 2013 legislature. So that's what these amendments do, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about them. We have John Wyckoff from OCCA, who is very much involved in these amendments, and he could answer any questions that I can't, I'm sure.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not many questions, but just some statements. I appreciate the amendments. I was just reviewing the original bill last night and saw a bunch of shalls and thou shalt do this, and my concern was leaving some independence to some institutions back and forth. Again, I like it because I think I shared my experience with you when I transferred to university. I got a note from mother first I took with me, and when said they would accept my credits, and 2 years later, 3 years later, when I went to apply for graduation, they said, if you don't qualify, and I had to pull out their note to remind them, to refresh their memories that, yes, they did. And so if we had some sort of standard that in place, that'd be good. I guess my last question would be, one more other comment was, I do like the transfer student Bill of Rights and responsibilities. I'm always wanting responsibility tied with rights, because students need to have some responsibility to do their work as well. And then secondly is joint boards of education. What's their opinion on this?
Well, the joint boards is the State Board of Higher Education and the State Board of Education. And State Board of Education because they also oversee community colleges. And they've been involved in the drafting of these amendments.
So they agree with the dash
yeah.
two, the dash twos?
That's my understanding. Well, they will.
In time.
Okay.
Those are good questions, Representative. I appreciate
Thank
those.
You.
Any other questions, committee, about the dash two amendments to House Bill 3521? Not, I'd entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3521, dated April 7th, 2011.
Okay. Rep. Dimbrough moves to adopt the dash two amendments dated 4-7-11 to House Bill 3521. Is there any discussion? Seeing is there any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3521, as amended, be sent with a due pass recommendation to the House Committee on Education.
Representative Dimbrough moves House Bill 3521, as amended with the dash two amendments, to the House Committee on Education with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion pertaining to that? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Parker?
Aye.
Excuse.
Yeah.
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
The motion passes. The bill passes. And I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3521. Do we need to open up an informational
mm-hmm.
hearing? We will now open up an informational hearing. This is an overview of Senate Bill 559 and Senate Joint Resolution 20. And as I said previously, we've got some highly esteemed guests here to talk about that. I'd first like to call up President Richard Lurvier to come and share with us. We have some time constraints mapped out, but we have some cushion built in here as well, so I want you guys to feel free to give us a thorough presentation, and we look forward to what you have. Thank you.
Well, Chairman Johnson, thank you very much for this opportunity and for your wisdom to build in a time cushion whenever you have academics in front of you. Members of the committee, I'm really grateful for not only for this opportunity, but for your steady interest in these issues and for your service. I know how much time out of your lives you devote for this. I know the munificent compensation that you receive for it, and we're deeply grateful to you. I've submitted written testimony. I'm not going to read it to you. I want to just make a few points as quickly as possible and then just wait for any questions or observations you might have. Sometimes it's useful to just step back a second and see where we are and remind ourselves of what we're trying to do. 20 years ago in 1991, the budget from the state for the University of Oregon was $63 million. Today, this fiscal year, we are projected to receive $58 million 20 years later. $8 million of that is federal stimulus money, so it's actually $50 million from the state. If we adjusted for inflation, that's a 43% decline in funding in those 20 years. And during that same period of time, we have had a 40% increase in enrollments. So it's almost an identical percentage cut and percentage increase in enrollment. Since 1991, tuition has gone up 241%. And we are dead last in the AAU in terms of per-student funding, per-student funding within the state among state universities, and salaries paid to our faculty. I know that you know these numbers as well as anyone, and I know that you understand the consequences as well as anyone. And I also know that you're as interested as anyone in what are we going to do about it. Autonomy for state universities is a very important first step. We fully support Senate Bill 242 and Senate Bill 909. We look forward to their passing. They are important. Our proposal is complementary to both of those bills, and I think our proposals address not just the autonomy question, but also begin to address the funding question. We have to engage in real reform if we're going to protect the interests of middle-class families in Oregon, because they are the ones who are most dramatically affected. Our new partnership proposal has three components to it: governance reform, Senate Bill 559, autonomy and local governing boards for the University of Oregon and for any other university that wants to opt into it. Increased accountability. We've had a group of faculty on our campus working for almost a year on accountability metrics. Not that we will be the ones to articulate them, but we want to have something to help this agency and others try to figure out exactly how that will work in terms of what the state wants. We want accountability for the public at a level that we can't have under the current structure. This is an $800 million a year enterprise, the University of Oregon, and we don't have a board of directors. We need greater and closer relationship with the public as represented by a board that is focused on the performance of the University of Oregon in articulating the demands and the needs of the public as represented by that board to the University of Oregon. The University of Oregon wants essentially the same kind of structure that OHSU has, the Port of Portland, all Oregon community colleges, University of Washington State, University of Michigan, Virginia, etc. What we're asking for is nothing unusual. It's actually quite the standard in public higher education. And, of course, then we also have proposed a new partnership in funding through Senate Joint Resolution 20. All of these things, I think, will help us ensure the access to a world-class education that we owe our young people. And when I say access, I mean A, having it available, and B, having it be affordable. We have listened very carefully to families and to students about the question of affordability, and you know as well as I do that people are in a pinch. That 241% increase in tuition has placed us at the level of $8,200 and some odd dollars per year in state tuition. If we do nothing, if we simply continue as in the way that we have in the past, tuition will be $17,000 a year in state in 10 years. That's not a guess. That's an extrapolation from the average rate of increase every year for the last 38 years. It's 7.5%. That 7.5% hasn't been a straight line. It's been a very jagged line with 20% increases one year and 2% increases the next because we all feel so bad. Then the bills come due and there's a 15% increase. You know what the consequences of this are. Consequences of this have been for our families. If we...
Mr. President?
Yes.
I've been told that you didn't introduce yourself. I'm sorry.
Oops. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I'm Richard LaRiviere, the president of the University of Oregon. Thank you.
My apologies.
I've got a card here with that.
It's okay.
Thank you. That 7.5% is an astonishing figure for me. And the fact that it's been jagged is what is causing our families the desperation that they feel. When a family figures out how much it's going to cost for that freshman year, they figure out how they're going to pay for it to the dollar. And then the awful realization sets in that they have no idea what it's going to cost next year, let alone the year after that or the year after that. I envision a situation in which, in fact, we have asked for an amendment to Senate Bill 559 that says that there will be a cap of 5% on tuition. Anything above that requires legislative approval. And under the funding model that we've proposed, with the bond matched by private money, mixed together, managed as an endowment with a predictable yield, I'm convinced that we can get the tuition and fees people, the housing people, the students themselves who assess very healthy fees on themselves. The budget for the ASUO at Associated Students of the University of Oregon is $12 million, and that's money they assess themselves. Get all of them around a table and make a commitment for every incoming freshman class of a rate of increase over 4 years, because tuition, fees, etc. will continue to go up. But make a commitment that for that group of people, you're going to confine yourself to a particular rate of increase, 4.5%, 5%, whatever it might be. Do the math for all 4 years, divide by four, and say to that incoming family, this is what it will cost every year for your child to get a degree in 4 years at the University of Oregon. I did this once before at Kansas, and the palpable relief in families was astonishing. I had mothers come up to me with tears in their eyes saying, thank you for the certainty around that cost. We have to do something like this, because we can't sit back and just watch this number go up and see a steady erosion in the ability of our students to avail themselves of this. I'm convinced that the four-year graduation rate is dramatically affected by just this problem. You have to step out for a term to earn a little bit of money, and one term turns into two terms is a year, etc. And nobody ever does the math about what that costs. They think simply about the cost of the tuition, but they've foregone their first year's income after that, getting that degree. Well, I feel like I'm preaching to the, if not the choir, at least a remarkably well-informed audience here. So I'm not going to go into the endless detail around the nuts and bolts of this. What we've got on the table is something that we think will work. But it's very important to understand that it isn't about winning the argument about whether this is a good idea or not. It's about how are we going to protect the institution, the University of Oregon, and the availability of that world-class education for every student who's qualified to take advantage of it, regardless of their financial circumstance. And we are backing into a situation where we are privatizing the university by simply allowing this steady increase in tuition without, to be perfectly blunt, without attending to an equally steady increase in financial aid. So it's not a level playing field by any measure. And we're turning this world-class education into an opportunity that's limited only to those people who have the money to pay for it. That's not the Oregon way. That's not what this institution was created to do. And it's not what any of us associated with this institution wanted to do. In conclusion, I think we're at a moment where there's greater awareness of these issues amongst the public than I've seen in a long time. There's been more sophisticated conversation around these issues in this legislature than I've ever seen in my career. This is a moment when we have an opportunity here, and I hope that we'll be able to seize the opportunity. So with that, I'll end my testimony and ask for any questions.
Thank you very much. Very good. Representative Lindsay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm supportive of this. And the words that I really like are, number one, accountability. Number two, local. And my favorite is autonomy. So I like those three words. The thing that I've been trying to wrap my brain around, you know, before I get there, is do private universities experience the same 7.5 jagged increase? And if not, why not, I guess?
Well, keep in mind that this is the academics caveat at the beginning of every generalization. There's always a counter example. But in general, private institutions haven't had the same frequency of those jagged increases. There may be a dramatic blow of mismanaged endowment or an economic moment that requires a dramatic increase, but it's a much steadier increase. It has been in general. And the reason is that they, frankly, don't live with the same rhythm of legislative appropriation process that public institutions do. So if you look at the cost of educating a student, it has been pretty flat. And almost nobody believes that when I first said it. But I'm talking about the cost of educating the student. The distribution of that cost has been dramatically shifting. So it used to be that there was a roughly 50-50 share between the student and the state. I'm talking now generally in the United States. And some states have moved faster than others, but in general, states are moving away from that 50% mark and steady decline. As that number goes down, tuition goes up. There's basically two sources of funding for at state universities: legislative appropriation and tuition. And to it, the cost to the student has gone up 241% over the last 20 years, but so has the decline from the state. We've gone from 40-some-odd percent down to, well, it'll be about 4% after this session if the governor's recommended budget holds. So the costs have gone up for educating the student in accordance with inflation, but the shift in who pays for it has been dramatically put back onto the shoulders of the families and the students themselves. And as long as we recognize that and we understand it and we stop pointing fingers at each other and saying it's your fault, we have to recognize where we are and what's happening to us as a society, and recognize the consequences, the long-term consequences, which I know you do from our conversations, Representative Lindsay. We have to step back and say, this isn't good for us. It's not good for us as a state. It's not good for us as a country. What are we going to do? I could pound the table here and say, you need to give us more money. But I know you don't have more money. And the likelihood that that's going to happen is zero. So what are we going to do? Are we going to simply sit back and say, let the market have its way? Whoever's got the money can avail themselves of this quality of education. I'm not comfortable with that at all.
And follow up, I guess more of a comment would be, with that scale down to 4%, all of a sudden we're competing directly with private universities, but they don't have the ties and the handcuffs that some public do. And I think if we're going to compete with private universities, then we need to have the flexibility as they have.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. President, could you talk a bit about the mechanisms that you put in place at Kansas that achieved the stability you referred to earlier, and how those compare with what's being proposed here in Oregon?
What we did at Kansas is we got every contributor to the cost of education around the table and said to them, make your best prediction for what your cost structure is going to look like over the next 4 years. And in the process, rode pretty hard, made people sharpen their pencils repeatedly. And we then sat down and figured out what the cost was, what the rate of increase was going to be in each of those years. I mean, sometimes we could we could tell that because of the construction of a dormitory, for example, that there was going to be an increase in cost in year two. We had to account for, but in this year there was very little cost, so we were as realistic as we possibly could be. Then we said, all right, sign in blood, this is what you're going to live with. And we then did the math, calculated what it would cost for those 4 years, and we said to every incoming freshman, this is your cost. This is the deal for you. And it's not going to go up. Tuition's not going up. Fees aren't going up. Dormitory costs aren't going to go up. This is what it will cost you. Now, we couldn't include textbooks because we had no control over that. We were vulnerable to things like fluctuations in natural gas prices, et cetera, but that's just when you're running a business, you got to figure out how to account for those things. And we did that for every incoming freshman class, so we could go back to that same group the next year and say, do your numbers still hold? Has something happened? Has there been a change? And we made minor adjustments. So you had the same phenomenon with the undergraduates that you have in an airplane, that the guy sitting next to you may have paid a lot more than you did for that seat, or some less, or not very much different. But what we discovered was that families never compared themselves to other families. They simply looked at the circumstance they were in. And when they did the math on that freshman year, they thought they had it figured out. Well, it turns out they don't, because of these spikes in tuition and fees. And we've come back to them and said, we came back to them at Kansas when I was there and said, this is the deal. Now, it had the added benefit of having a very serious fifth-year penalty involved. If you didn't graduate in 4 years, your fifth year was now at the same rate as that incoming freshman class, which is almost certainly going to be higher than yours. Mm. So there was an added incentive to get out in 4 years. Now, we did that in my second year at Kansas, and I've been away for now, it's been in place for 3 years, so I can't really point to a clear track record of consequence for that. But I know it's doable, and that's exactly what I hope to be able to do here. Part of the reason that it was viable in Kansas, and we can't do that here, is that Kansas at the time was getting 24% of its operating budget from the state, and we're getting 4%. So we need to have a much more predictable source of revenue than we have right now.
Appreciate that. Representative Dimbrough?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. Just first of all, just to follow up on that 4%, you know, that's terrible news that it has sunk that low. But on some level, it's also good news,
yes,
right?
Sure.
Because it means that the university has been attracting much more outside financing, right? Grants, and that has also brought down the the proportion of the state share, and that's a great thing, and it's a tribute to the faculty and the mm-hmm. you know, the research establishment and everything that you do. And just in response to Rep. Lindsay's question about, so to what extent, you know, are you still really a public institute? I mean, to what extent is the public still investing in the university? The public does have significant investment in the infrastructure of the university, right? The
Absolutely.
Buildings, the property, everything.
Yes, and thank you for raising that. There has been the allegation that this is a plan to privatize a public university. And it's actually exactly the opposite. Someone said to me the other day, well, if you were going to raise $800 million to match the state bond, how would you know that the donors weren't going to control the university? And I said, well, we're getting 4% from the state. The donors, if they were going to control the university, would already be in control. The fact of the matter is that in order to preserve the public mission, the reason these institutions were created in the first place was not to displace Harvard and Yale, but to provide a quality of education similar to that to people who couldn't avail themselves of Harvard and Yale. That's what our mission is. We want a world-class education, second to none, available to that kid from Heppner who couldn't imagine himself going to the East Coast or to Los Angeles or whatever for an education, but can just go over those mountains and has access to an education that will set that young person up for life. And that's what we do. And it's magical. Anytime the nonsense gets about knee-deep in my office, all I have to do is walk across that campus, and you see the promise, the enthusiasm, the confidence that they're going to fix all the things that we've screwed up. And it just, if you could bottle it, you'd be a gazillionaire. It's magic.
Thank you, Mr. President. And now a follow-up. You're telling us about the experience you had in Kansas with the sort of certainty and predictability of the tuition. I find that very interesting. And the Western Oregon University is doing something along those lines, right, with its Western promise.
I understand, yes.
Yeah. Is that a model that the university could potentially use? That's a fairly new program, so we're not quite sure how it's going to work out. It's so far so good, it seems. That's a path,
yes,
that the university, yeah, could take.
Keep in mind that I've only spoken with President Minahan at a very high level about this, just basically sort of saying, oh, well, it's very similar, you know, we both said that to one another. So I don't know any details. I know he has expressed anxiety from time to time since I've been here about the viability of that long term, given the rate of erosion of state support. But he's also done, President Minahan in particular, has done a superb job of recruiting international students to pay out-of-state tuition to help subsidize the education of Oregonians.
Yeah. And they've also had to maintain a pretty large reserve. I mean, that's something I think you,
right,
would have to do,
exactly,
if you were going to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looking at the SJR 20 and the idea of building an endowment that could be parlayed into operations. Could you speak to that a little more? I assume we'll have a panel that will be addressing the details,
yes,
about that. But I'm interested in hearing you about the larger concept of going out to potential donors, supporters of the university to help with the fund an endowment that would fund the operations of the university. What is stopping the university from doing that right now?
Well, we intend to do that no matter what. We have to. It's a key component of our future. As the money from the state goes away, we have to follow different ways of funding. So we will raise money aggressively no matter what. The reason that the bonding issue came up at all was the unpredictability of funding is the problem. And you know this as well as I. We know in February what we're getting for the academic year that began the previous June. And it's almost impossible to effectively and efficiently run the place based on that structure. So how could we take the uncertainty away? That was the goal. This legislative body cannot commit future legislative bodies in terms of appropriation. There's only one way that we know that we could make the state's contribution, whatever size it is, predictable, and that's through this bonding mechanism. So then sitting around the table thinking about that, we said to ourselves, why would not any state agency then want that, to eliminate this certainty? What can we bring to the table that could induce the state to want to enter into this? And that's where the match, the dollar-for-dollar match notion came up. I mean, that's something that universities can do that the prison system probably can't do.
An alumni fund.
That's a very entertaining
idea. Yes, it is.
So that's where it came from, and it's about, it's not about the bonding idea as a virtuous idea in and of itself. It's about how do we make predictable the funding so we can enter into that deal with our incoming freshmen. And if somebody's got a better idea about how to get there, great, we'll take it. Does that answer your question, Representative Dimbro?
It does. And, you know, I know that in the future we're going to be looking, that we're going to be having extended conversations about local boards and about performance metrics, and I really welcome those. I think it's going to be very, very useful conversation, you know, to sort of calmly and deliberatively look at those issues and see really what's best for a particular institution as well as for the overall system, you know, because that's the other piece of this. You know, there are concerns out there that, you know, what Oregon is proposing might be good for Oregon, I mean, Oregon, University of
right.
Oregon, but perhaps, you know, could have a detrimental effect on other universities within the system. And so, you know, I think as we're looking at this, that's what we have to look at, certainly as a legislature, mm-hmm. is the integrity of the overall post-secondary effort.
If I may, I obviously have been involved in those conversations as much as, if not more than you have been. And this new partnership does not come at the expense of other institutions. And in fact, we have drafted both 559 has a provision in it that any other university that wants local governing boards can avail itself. We've drafted SJR 20 to say any university that wants to do this. And by the way, the legislature's left with the option of matching any of these depending on the capacity of the state to enter into debt. So it's not that there's a commitment here that is going to come back to haunt the state. That will be a judgment made on a regular basis by the legislature. I have never had anyone articulate to me how this will be detrimental to any other institution. I've had a lot of this could be bad for other people statements made, but nobody has said here's how it will be to our detriment. And I'm quite willing to modify whatever we've proposed to protect other institutions. It's not that we want to get an unfair advantage or anything else. This is our contribution to helping us solve these problems that we've talked about. And I'm open and enthusiastic for anything that will improve these ideas.
Thank you. Representative Harker, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've got to keep ourselves moving. We're
okay,
graciously extending some extended comments to the
representative. I fully appreciate that, especially since I was supposed to be in another meeting 20 minutes ago. But I cannot leave when you are here testifying again before us, Mr. President. Thank you so much for being here, for taking the time, and I'll speak quickly, and for bringing the boldness to our attention, bringing the ideas that are out there. And I just want to say to my colleagues, again, I would be preaching to the choir because they all know where I stand on this issue, and it's even gotten a little bit of press lately. But we are so lucky as a state to have recruited some of the individuals that we have in the higher ed institution. And we heard from one of them just 2 days ago, I think, if my mind isn't blurred, having President Beeble here and President Riviere today.
Thank you.
And we are truly indebted to you for the energy that you bring and the passion that you exhibit when you talk about what's going on those campuses and what a world-class education does for not just that individual, but the ripples that go out from that life that are forever changed and bring change to communities and to economies. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And I have to go talk about a wireless network.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
President, great comment. Appreciate your time. All right. We'd like to call up panel number one, Larry Bruton and Chris Smith. We have approximately 20 minutes per panel allocated. I'd like to see if we could get down to maybe 15 a bit. That would help us to make sure we have time for everybody. So please identify yourselves and share with us as you're able.
Good I'd like to thank the co-chairs.
Could you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. Okay. I apologize. My name is Larry Bruton.
Thank you.
Again, I'd like to thank the co-chairs for having this very important hearing. I think it's significant that, kind of given where the discussion is in this process, that you are holding an informational hearing now and keeping this dialogue moving forward. I'm a partner at Zimmer Gunst Prask Architects in Portland and a U of O Foundation trustee. I'm also a native Oregonian and a graduate of the University of Oregon, so I have a long interest in the quality of education in the state. Appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly to you today about the importance of higher education reform and why I think that the policies in the new partnership proposal that Richard just described are critical to achieving tuition certainty, funding stability, and true accountability for the education we provide the next generation of Oregon leaders. I understand that this legislative session is focused on statewide systems and governance. The agreement between the governor and President LaRiviere to address that first makes sense, but we cannot let that be the end of the higher education debate. We must commit to continuing this dialogue so that the next session we're prepared to take action on the real issues that impact our students, our families, and the quality of higher education. The additional time for us to work on SB 559 and SJR 20 also allows us to better educate the public as well as policymakers about how these bills can work and how they can help us to achieve our collective goals for greatness in post-secondary education in Oregon. Under the current system, there is little accountability for the money we invest in higher education. Senate Bill 559 would change that and create a truly transparent and accountable system with performance measurements and consequences for failing to meet clear performance outcomes. Senate Bill 559 will decentralize an outdated governance structure by allowing universities to establish local governing boards that will be accountable to the State Board of Higher Education or other state coordinating council on 12 performance measures. The local governing boards will also have increased oversight and authority to make decisions that affect the university and its students and faculty on a daily basis. Similar to Oregon's community colleges, Oregon Health and Sciences University, and neighboring University of Washington. With the increased independence comes increased accountability for results. Under the current system, there's also no tuition certainty for Oregon students, which Richard certainly addressed. As the state funding declines and costs our universities go up, so does tuition. We must end. We're pricing too many Oregonians out of higher education, which is an injustice for individual Oregonians and hurts our state's economic competitiveness. With an amendment offered by Senator Edwards, Senate Bill 559 will establish a 5% tuition cap for resident undergraduates, guaranteeing the new UO board will have to seek legislative and gubernatorial approval for any tuition increase that exceeds 5%. This provides students tuition certainty and allows them to plan more accurately for the cost of a four-year degree. No other plan provides greater tuition certainty for Oregonians. And lastly, I don't need to tell you that the current funding system is broken. The governor's unified investment board is a step in the right direction to help break down the barriers and end the competition for funding between each sector of education in the state every 2 years. But a unified board won't solve the fundamental issue: stable, predictable, and adequate funding. SJR 20 is a legislative referral that asks the voters whether or not state bonds can be used to fund state endowments. If approved by the voters, the terms and conditions are approved by the legislature, including requirements that meet its end of the bargain with private matching donations. The legislature always retains control of the amount and timing of bonds. And after a certain period, the bonds are paid off and the U of O becomes self-sustaining from a funding perspective, but still very much a public university, continuing to advance our greater mission of access to an affordable and quality education for all Oregonians. The bottom line is that if we take the next necessary steps as outlined in the new partnership proposals, in 5 years, we will have dramatically improved the education we're providing through our public universities. We will see greater tuition certainty for students and families, increased percentage of in-state students attending the University of Oregon, increased minority student population, improved retention rates from first and second year students, increased graduation rates, greater individual attention with smaller student-faculty ratio, higher standards for enrollment, a more valuable college degree, and an educated workforce for Oregon. The urgency around this issue couldn't be greater. I want to thank you for, you know, this committee's leadership and commitment to making 2011 the beginning of our reform so that we can come back in 2012 ready to take the next most meaningful steps toward greatness for our universities. And I just wanted to add, kind of, you know, anecdotally to my prepared comments, as I mentioned at the outset, I'm a partner in a major architectural firm in a state probably too big for the state, particularly in this economy. But we're a firm of almost 500 people. 250 of those are here in Oregon. We have offices in Seattle, in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and New York City. I was talking the other day to the CEO of another major Northwest firm that has offices in 10 cities around the United States. What we both noticed is that the economic recovery is beginning to get traction in almost every other part of the country except for the Northwest. We're seeing a long, steady climb out of this. What that means for us, what we're talking about, is that makes the quality people, the creative, you know, all we have as a, you know, as a business to provide a service is the quality of the people that we have. That makes them very vulnerable to being wooed to other parts of the country where there is greater opportunity and in an increasing economy. And while we grow the economy in the Northwest out of this, that means as firms we have to give a great deal of attention to retention of the talent that we have, or it's going to really impact us. The same is true for our universities. As the economic recovery takes place, I've talked to a number of faculty members at the University of Oregon, and they are losing faith and optimism that this, you know, that the future of higher education here is going to be stable and is going to be the place. Lifestyle doesn't do it alone anymore. So I just say that to reinforce the urgency of dealing this. In our business, we would say, you know, we don't have time to sit around admiring the problem any longer. We can't kick the can down the road. We've got to deal with it, get it going, and, you know, ensure the quality of education that we have continues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. Yeah. Mr. Smith, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Denbrough and Johnson, members of the committee. My name is Chris Smith. I reside in Lake Oswego. I am a trustee of the Foundation of the University of Oregon. I'm a graduate of the university, but I am not a native Oregonian. I came here to go to college. I liked it. I liked the University of Oregon. I got a great education. I'm still here. I built two businesses while being here, CAS Properties and Design Systems Northwest. I'm a longtime supporter of education, music, and the arts in Oregon. For over 30 years, my companies were involved in the Oregon economy as developers, building, and landscape designers, as well as general contractors. During that time, we employed directly and indirectly hundreds of Oregon citizens. One of our goals was to ensure the fact that the individuals that worked for us were able to leave us, go off and form their own companies, and grow in the state of Oregon based upon good education and the training we were able to give them in our firm. I wouldn't have been able to do that without the education I received in architecture at the University of Oregon. Oregon's economy is sustained by Oregon-grown small businesses. We need to keep in mind Oregon doesn't have an economy like Washington or some of the other states with huge industry. We build our businesses here. 75% of Oregon firms have less than 50 employees. That means we need to train our people here to get a good education to be able to continue and grow in our state. I truly believe that in order to continue to grow small businesses like mine in Oregon, we must have an educated workforce. I think you believe as well, which is why you've already undertaken efforts at reforming our system of higher education. I commend you for the efforts. However, here today, you've heard from Richard, you've heard from Larry, you'll hear from others, and you will continue to hear from them, that we need to go further with what we're doing. We need to take the next steps forward. I join the vast majority of Oregonians who believe restructuring the Oregon University system as proposed by Governor Kitzhaber in Senate Bill 909 is an important first step, but it's just a first step. It's vitally important that we take the next steps proposed with Senate Bill 559 and SJR 20. Based on my business background and my work with a variety of nonprofit boards and organizations, I really can't fathom the idea of an $800 million enterprise operating without a dedicated board. Every organization has very specific needs and interests, and a localized board is more flexible, responsive, and accountable. I opened my business in the mid-70s at a time when Oregon's economy was active and vibrant. However, by the early 80s, we were in a severe recession, much like we are today. Many firms like mine were forced to close. Many individuals were under or unemployed, consequently leaving our state, which we're beginning to see again, as Larry mentioned. Because of the excellent broad-based education I received in architecture, my business expanded each year, which provided me with the ability to give back to the state I've adopted and I truly love. Oregon is a wonderful place to do business. It has doors that are open that other states don't have. The integrity in this state is incredible, and we need to continue that based on our education. If we don't make substantial changes now to save our education system, we will not retain the best and the brightest youth, as they'll have other opportunities in other states and move on. We won't be able to live near and watch our children and our children's children have a future in Oregon, find meaningful employment, and raise families of their own. The University of Oregon has done a great job in teaching entrepreneurial creativity, leadership, and business ethics, which set a really strong foundation for our future citizens to grow their businesses and their lives and their families here in Oregon. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 559 and SJR 20 when they come to the floor, as a new partnership is a package of comprehensive higher education reforms. We owe it to the future generations to act bravely and boldly to ensure our economy gets moving again. More people start businesses, more students have the opportunity to pursue their dreams and remain Oregonians. We have, in the disadvantages of being underfunded, a huge advantage in the fact we're Oregon. Oregon's always been a very creative state. We have managed to solve our own problems. If you look educationally in the states of Washington and California, you can see the devastation in California. You're beginning to see it now in Washington. Oregon is on the edge. With new great ideas, we can move forward, and we can set an example for the West Coast and have the best institutions here. Please look seriously at these bills, consider them further, and pass them so that we're able to move ahead and lead the Western United States with education. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate both of your comments. I would just add, you know, there are a lot of people in the building that have the little lapel pins that say jobs, you know, J-O-B-S, but it'd be great if we could come up with a hybrid pin that would say investing in higher ed equals jobs, because I don't think there are enough people in this building or in this governmental structure that really understand that. But I can honestly say, as a part of being a part of this committee through this session, that, you know, higher ed has been far too undervalued as a economic driving force, not just in Oregon but in national economies, and you can, I think, draw a direct cause-effect relationship to the decision to divest in higher ed in this state and where we are economically.
We both sit here as examples of that. Our educations at Oregon allowed us to make a good living.
Exactly.
In this state,
I agree.
Which is wonderful.
And the, you know, the kind of current structure we have was devised when getting someone through high school was the number one priority.
Exactly.
And higher education was a bonus. The structural changes that are suggested here, looking at education, the administrative assistants in my firm virtually have to have bachelor's degrees today to you know, to work in the industry because of how highly technical stuff it is. So the future of higher education is the future of the economy in the state of Oregon.
And I'm encouraged that we're finally starting to look at all of public education as a continuum. You know, it's not just higher ed, but it's how do the kids feeding into that system need to be prepared so that they're able to excel to their ultimate achievement level. So thank you both. Appreciate your comments. Okay, the next panel will be Zachary Taylor, Bruce Waltz, and Cindy Astley.
Thank you.
Welcome. Whoever's first can.
I guess I win the draw. Good afternoon, co-chairs Dembro and Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Cindy Astley, and I live here in Salem. I'm here to testify in support of the current Governor's Education Plan, Senate Bill 909. It includes a reform for higher education, which is very important. This legislation allows the ability to improve the overall framework of higher education, but it's just a beginning. The University of Oregon's proposal partnership plan outlined in Senate Bill 559 and Senate Joint Resolution 20 is the rest of the structure. You can't have a structure without a foundation, but the foundation doesn't make the structure. I appreciate the legislature's focus on higher education, and as a state, we cannot miss the opportunity to set public universities on a path to stable funding and ensure that a college education remains in reach for all Oregonians that want one. I'm not here before you today because I'm a duck, but I am. I'm not here today because I'm on the alumni board, but I am. I'm not here because I'm an Oregonian, but I am. I'm here because I'm a single mom of two boys looking to go to school. I've talked to my boys about college education forever, and basically the theme is, you will go. Luckily, they want to, and they have a responsibility, and they know what that is. They have to get good grades, they have to get accepted, and they have to pay for one term of each year of their 4 years to achieve a bachelor's degree. All scholarships, grandparent money, what falls from the sky into their little pockets, and what they earn goes towards their terms. The clinker to this whole plan is how much is a term. It's hard for young students, and quite frankly myself as the mom, to save without a solid dollar figure in mind. I know firsthand that rising cost of tuition is making college unattainable for the middle class. And I know, personally, that I'm not saving enough. My sons and I are guessing when it comes to what they will, their university will, their tuition will cost. And under the current system, we're guessing that they'll need $17,000 per year. That's $5,100 per term for their education. For my sons, I've discussed their roles and their responsibilities over the last couple months as I've looked deeper into this issue, and I've let them know that what I'm doing is to support all students in Oregon so that they have the same benefit. When I was reading my testimony a few weeks ago, my youngest blurted out, and I quote, "Mom, I have to save $24,000? Mom, I need a better paying job, because unloading the dishwasher at 25 cents a pop ain't going to cut it." Out of the mouth of babes. Luckily, Matthew, as you can tell, has quite a quick mind for math, and hopefully there's a scholarship that will be coming his way shortly. Over many decades, Oregon's higher education funding has suffered. I saw a quote the other day from Javier Pascal Salcido, and I felt it was appropriate. Bureaucracy is the art of making the possible impossible. When I saw that this quote, I spent a lot of time thinking about, we talk a lot about the what ifs, and we spend so much time in this area that we never realize what can be. Disinvestment in bureaucracy has made higher education access a little bit impossible, and it's made it completely impossible to save for. At this time, when college education is increasingly important to a person's ability to compete in the 21st century, Oregon cannot afford to let this disinvestment of higher education continue and what-ifing our decline to death. I have a favorite poem called Builder, and I'm just going to recite two lines. Am I a builder who works with care, measuring life by rule and square? Or am I a wrecker who stalks the town, content with the labor of tearing down? I know each one of you did not become a legislator to tear down Oregon, but to build her up so that we can live in the greatest state in the nation, and I applaud your service. It is an exciting time to be a legislator, however, because you have a great opportunity to build a system to stabilize higher education and make sure that your constituents, your kids and grandkids, and my sons have the opportunity to go to college in the great state that you helped to build. Please capitalize on this opportunity to be the architect for the future of higher education. I support the governor's plan this year in Senate Bill 909, but remember that's just the foundation and that stabilizing higher education must continue next year. We have to build walls, insulate them, and put a roof on it. And those elements are securely found in the partnership plan outlined in Senate Bill 559 and Senate Joint Resolution 20 this year. I wish and hope that you support them as furiously as I do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson and Dembro and committee members. For the record, my name is Bruce Waltz, and I reside in McMinnville. I recently retired after 35 years serving in the K-12 system, the last 22 as an elementary principal in McMinnville, and I've spent a good part of my career working with kids hoping they go to higher education. One of the reasons this matters to me is I'm one of eight members of my family, starting with my grandfather in 1914, that attended the U of O, including a nephew who's there currently, and 10 other members of my family who attended either Western or Eastern or OSU. So it's a big issue for me because I have grandchildren ready to, kind of like your kids, ready to go. My career as an educator, I worked to give our students top quality education in the schools I serve, both as a teacher and as an administrator. I did my best to prepare them to continue so they could pursue a college education. That was my message. You can always do better than where you are. In my time, I've seen Oregon continue to cut funding for public colleges. This has been mentioned several times already. And pushing a college degree out of the reach of many students. So consequently, they go not at all or somewhere else, and we're losing valuable resources in our state. I think I'm among the majority of people in our state who don't think this is acceptable, and I believe it's time for change. Obviously, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't. You have proposals in front of you that address both funding and governance, and I think that it's time that Oregon, and not just the university, but our other public institutions also, start to meet the needs of our children where they are so they can have that ability to improve our state and improve themselves. We don't want to see them priced out of education, and that's beginning to happen. The governance bill, and as an educator, I think of school board, although I think a board on a university of $800 million budgets can be a far different dynamic than one of 50. But I can't imagine running an organization of that size without people around you who understand what's going on, local issues, governance issues to that particular place and its needs. And I think that's a very important thing to consider because it brings in the stakeholders for that institution, whichever one it is. And I think about my time at the University of Oregon, and you know, you can't capsulize a four-year time period in a couple minutes, but it set a course for my life with friends, with organizations, with direction, with vision for what life could be, and I'm happy to give back as a member of the Alumni Association and as an alumni. I think that as I speak with you, I know how much difference a university education can make. I've seen it in my life. I've seen it in others. It's been critical for all the people I know. I've seen it change the lives of family, of friends, of former students. And I could recount many stories about students who wanted to attend and were qualified but couldn't at this point because of the funding issue. So I am sure that you're all aware of the research that shows that this current generation of Oregonians will probably be less educated than their parents. And I don't think that's tolerable as an educator. I don't think it should be tolerable as someone involved in governance because that leads to the downfall of our state. I think you have an opportunity by supporting these bills to make a real difference to the state of Oregon in the future and have an impact on individual lives as well as the well-being of our state. And I hope you avail yourselves of the opportunity to vote for both the bills in a positive manner. In conclusion, as you take the opportunity to review these things, I'm sure that in this state that you want to ensure that this generation of students has the same kind of opportunities my generation had and yours did. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Zachary.
Co-Chair Dembro, Co-Chair Johnson, and members of the committee,
My name is Zachary Taylor, and I'm a junior studying public policy at the University of Oregon. First off, I want to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to share my perspective as somebody who is directly impacted by this debate. As an Oregon resident, and as a student currently in Oregon's public university system, I want my voice to be heard as this committee and the rest of the legislature takes up higher education reform. Let me paint for you the picture on the ground. Recent tuition hikes have simply made college unaffordable for many of my peers who have had to opt out of a college education as a result. No student should have to drop out of school because the cost is too high. And we need bold action from our elected officials to curb this trend and make Oregon college education affordable and accessible to every student. The status quo makes it particularly hard for students and families to plan for education costs. Even families that have planned for years to send their kids to college cannot cope with sudden spikes in tuition like ones we've seen in recent years. Students and families need stable tuition rates to make college affordable and accessible. I believe that it is important to improve governance of our universities. I appreciate the fact that the new partnership is working to improve student access by creating a local governing board with a designated student position, and I appreciate that the governor has taken steps to improve the transition from K through 12 schools to community colleges and universities. But I want to make sure we don't lose focus of the issue of figuring out how to afford next year's tuition when we don't even know how much it will increase. Should we expect 8%, 9%, even 10%? That's why my fellow students and I are so encouraged by the new partnership's inclusion of a 5% tuition cap for resident undergraduates. This will ensure that tuition cannot continue to increase at such rapid rates, and that students can adequately plan for our four-year undergraduate education. President LaRiviere and the governor's aligned plan is a bold step in the right direction in addressing this increasing problem. I applaud their efforts and ask you to support them in their quest to make the dream of a college education a reality for the students in Oregon. To conclude, I'm here because I believe in the public mission, and I believe that offering access to Oregon students, to college-bound students, should be a priority. And I know that doesn't come as news to all of you. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to thank you for your time and for your consideration.
Thank you, Zachary. That's great. That's the second time you've appeared before us. Isn't that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thanks so much. I just had a follow-up for you. We heard earlier, I think, from the president about one of the reasons why it may be taking students longer, obviously, to get through their career is just the idea that the increases in tuition, the cost, the expense makes them have to take a break, earn some more money, and then re-enter the system again. Just from your experience with students at the U of O that you come in contact with, how prevalent is that? Do you have friends, colleagues who are experiencing that?
Yeah. Actually, I have several friends that that have had to take a break. Even like in the first 2 years of their education, drop out, take a break from the University of Oregon, and maybe attend LCC, Lane Community College, or just work because the prices are so fluctuating.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Great. Appreciate that. Any other follow-ups for our panel? Representative Lindsay.
Thanks, and this is really to Zachary. I guess I'd just like to get what the atmosphere is with students on campus right now that are graduating with a lot of debt and can't find a job. I'm concerned that I wonder if we're, in our vernacular, we're saying get as much education as you can, you get a great job. Mm-hmm. And that's not happening right now. At least I know all my law school friends that are graduating, or morale is pretty low. And I'm just wondering if there's any talk of it's not worth it. It's not worth the debt. I'm just concerned that there might be some talk. If you wouldn't mind just commenting a little bit on the morale and commentary among students right now.
Yeah, I have several friends that have either recently graduated or are planning on graduating sometime this spring or next fall, or I mean next summer. I'll just say overall, you know, none of them regret their education at the university by any means. However, I would say that, you know, in some cases, they may be a little bit lost as far as, you know, what they're going to do immediately after they graduate and, adjust to life in the real world. But overall, I think that, many of them are prepared, you know, and have made the choice to deal with the debt that they've incurred.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up to Representative Lindsay's question, I wonder, are you hearing conversations from students who think that Oregon may be a more difficult place to find their placed employment versus other states or other areas of the country? As you guys have conversations, has that ever come up?
Not a ton, but I do know that it depends on the field, their field sure. of interest. And, you know, for certain, departments, certain educations, certain degrees that they've attained, Oregon, is a pretty good spot for them. But in some cases, they do look elsewhere.
Great. Well, thank you. Any other comments?
Thanks. I want to make a comment. Maybe Zachary, you might follow on this. A lot of our students are also very reliant on the Oregon Opportunity Grant, right? So as we're concerned about it, I think we need to be doing a much better job of funding our universities, but we also need to be doing a better job of funding the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And, both of those levers are really equally important. And, how much you put into the one versus how much you put into the other, is always a very tricky issue, particularly when both are severely underfunded. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you yourself are a recipient of the Opportunity Grant, but I'm sure you know many people who are and how important it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can comment, I think, one of the interesting things about this whole issue is that, as a recipient of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, I've benefited from scholarships, both, locally, I'm from Cottage Grove, Oregon, and from the University of Oregon. However, I think, with these tuition spikes, I've had many friends, as a senior in high school, looking to go to college that, their parents had set aside money for them, as like lower middle class families. And in that case, they have struggled, in some ways more than I have financially, to go to college, just because they don't qualify for some of these grants, but they don't have enough money, given the rise in tuition costs.
Right. So it's not enough to fund the Opportunity Grant. We also have to keep tuition itself affordable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. To help out the middle class. Yeah.
Well, thank you, panel. Appreciate your testimony. We'll call our next panel forward now, and I believe these are three faculty members, Hill Walker, Ian McNeely, and John Chalmers. And colleagues, while they're coming forward, I wanted to just point out a couple of constituents that walked into the room recently here. We actually have a couple of potential higher ed students of the future there. Allie Danko and Alex Melton are here from Hunter Valley High School, and they're actually here to testify on a Senate bill relating, is it a Senate bill or a House bill, relating to the bottle bill expansion this afternoon. So, welcome. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Representatives Denbro, Johnson, Springer, and Lindsay. Thank you for the opportunity to share some brief remarks with you today about the new U of O partnership proposal, Senate Bill 559, SJR 20, as well as the Governor's Oregon Education Investment Board.
Could you please identify yourself for the record?
Senate Bill 901. My name is Hill Walker.
Thank you.
Been a faculty member in the U of O College of Education since 1967. So one thing for sure, I'm old. For 26 of those years, I directed the Center on Human Development at the university, and I currently serve on the U of O Alumni Board. By any measuring standard, Oregon's investment in education has fallen to dismal levels. The U of O soon will receive less than 7% of its funding from the state of Oregon. Oregon now ranks at the bottom of universities of which it's a member for state funding per student. There's considerable agreement that this disinvestment threatens our ability to deliver a high-quality education for U of O students. The new partnership addresses this funding issue through the creation of a public-private endowment. It tackles the two recurring problems of long-term disinvestment and short-term funding instability. In order to thrive, the U of O needs long-term sustainability as well as short-term stability. The Governor's Investment Board, in my view, would coordinate education effectively from preschool through graduate school and would also address these needs and problems more effectively than is now the case. The new partnership governance model resembles that found at many of today's public and private universities across the nation, and will provide the U of O with the flexibility it needs to meet the challenges that it currently faces. Governing boards enjoy sweeping powers as a rule, but they rarely interfere with the academic missions of the universities they govern. The proposed U of O governance model is unusually inclusive in that it features both student and faculty representatives as members. To make the partnership work as envisioned, however, it is essential that the fiscal elements of it be addressed, not just the governance issues. And I'd just like to note that having been at the university for 44 years, I've seen lots of change, and there has not been a governance proposal that remotely approaches this one in terms of its innovativeness and the potential for enhancing the institution's ability to address its core mission. The governor's plan to create an Oregon Education Investment Board represents an important step in reforming Oregon's entire system of education, including higher education. It will provide urgently needed coordination throughout a student's educational journey. It will also align standards and better enable students to manage the difficult transition from high school to college, thus ensuring, hopefully, that they will be more fully prepared to succeed in their college experience. I just want to make a few remarks about transitions. In their schooling path, students have to make four critically important transitions. And for those students that are fortunate enough to have a preschool experience, one of the most important transitions they can make is from preschool to elementary. For those students, many of whom are at risk and unprepared for schooling, who don't have a preschool experience, that transition carries much greater risk and is more difficult for the student. The next transition that's really important is from elementary to middle school, and then middle to high school and finally high school to college. The peak of the dropout rate is in grade 9, which is generally the transition from middle to high school. Many elementary and middle school students don't get the experiences and supports that they need to manage the transition effectively to high school. And we really need to invest more heavily, I think, in the start of schooling, the kind of start that a student manages to their schooling career is highly predictive of school success. School success, in turn, predicts a host of positive outcomes. And it also functions somewhat like a vaccine in that it protects students from a variety of negative destructive outcomes, such as dropout, drug and alcohol use, rejection by peers, teachers, and others, and so on. So I believe that these reform proposals will increase the holding power of Oregon's K-12 schooling enterprise and will deliver cohorts of high school graduates that are much better able to successfully negotiate their college experience. So thank you.
Thank you.
Greetings, Chairman Dembrough and Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Ian F. McNeely, and I'm an associate professor of history at UL. At UL, I chair several faculty committees, including our university-wide academic council. In that capacity, I have studied the new partnership in detail, asked President LaRiviere tough questions about it from a faculty perspective, and led the production of a report endorsing the plan. The UL Academic Council report found first that the new partnership's financial model is a sound and compelling one. It offers a very elegant way to leverage what remains of the state's contribution to raise private funds for a public purpose. At the same time, it solves both the problems of long-term disinvestment and short-term instability. Academic investments like library collections and faculty positions are measured in decades, not in biennial cycles, and this partnership offers a way to solve that problem. Second, we found that the proposed UL board resembles the governance systems of very many universities across the nation, both public and private. I admit when I saw the sweeping powers conferred upon this board, financial, academic, and otherwise, I was a bit alarmed. But the more research I did into the structures of governance, again, at both private and public universities nationwide, the more I was reassured. Now, we in Oregon like to be very inclusive, very democratic, and so I, too, applaud the inclusion of both student and faculty representatives and a delegate from the State Board of Higher Education, or its successor, as members. Third, we noted that the separate OUS plan laid out in Senate Bill 242, despite offering some relief from burdensome micromanagement, does not adequately address the problem of disinvestment and funding instability in the way that the new partnership emphatically does. Fourth, we raised the most questions regarding the performance benchmarks that would be imposed on the UO under the new partnership. I like to think of these benchmarks as taking the hundreds of tiny strings that the state currently uses to control UO and replacing them with a dozen or so giant levers. From the faculty's perspective, there is a small risk that increasing our accountability to the state in this way will actually squelch the freedom and the flexibility that have historically enabled great universities to flourish. But from the state's perspective, performance benchmarks would allow representatives and state officials more effectively to monitor and control how well the institution serves its public mission. This power, it seems, is an appropriate trade-off for other aspects of the new partnership that move us toward greater autonomy. As a relatively young faculty member who plans to retire in about 30 years, I may have to live with this proposal or the failure to enact it for longer than anyone else in this room. So let me end on a personal note. 11 years ago, I turned down a job at a wealthy private university in Manhattan to come to the University of Oregon. The pay is lower here, but the grass is literally greener. I've never regretted it because the academic differences between America's best private and best public universities are actually not all that great. The UO punches well above its weight already. It is a national treasure and for that reason an asset to the people of Oregon as well. The new partnership is the only plan before the legislature that preserves UO's national academic reputation and its dedication to Oregonians at the same time. It's a win-win proposal, and I urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, members of the committee. Thank you to the co-chairs, Dembro and Johnson. My name is John Chalmers. I'm the finance department head and associate professor of finance at the Lundquist College of Business, which is part of the University of Oregon. I'm also a parent of three sons, two of whom are currently students at the University of Oregon. I'm here to represent a report that the Senate Budget Committee wrote, and that Senate Budget Committee is composed of faculty from around the campus, including chemistry, economics, their members, ex officio members from math, and from biology as well. This committee is no shrinking violet, just as Ian's committee is not a group of shrinking violets. We've asked the president hard questions, we've evaluated the new partnership, and I think we have come up with three things that our committee believes. And in my experience, it's a somewhat uncharacteristic unanimity among these people with very different points of view and very different expertise. So the Senate Budget Committee believes that the new partnership is a huge leap forward. It provides a plan that can improve the quality and access to the University of Oregon in a way that no other plan that we've seen has the possibility of doing. The primary benefits have been stated in various ways, but we agree with those statements. Predictable funding, which leads to the ability to provide students with predictable tuition. I think that's a very, very important component of this plan. It also provides, and this isn't something that anybody said, but it provides for a substantial likelihood that we're going to receive more money each year, not less. And that's something that under the current system is new. The current system, our expectation is not more money. It's also a very valuable fundraising tool, and I think the matching gift portion of this demonstrates the partnership between the state and the university to the private donors in a very tangible way. And I think that's a critical part of that fundraising tool. A donor doesn't, I'm not a fundraiser, but I know within the college we talk to people who do give the College of Business money. The last thing they want to do is give a gift and then have the college say, well, we'll just spend your money and we don't need to put our money in there anymore. Likewise, a donor to the university says, if I'm going to give you money, why should I give you money if all that means is the state then pulls back additional support? I want my money to be leveraged, not to be a substitute. And I think that's a very important factor in the ability to make this work in response to one of the questions raised earlier. I think the risks, and we took these very seriously, extended market downturns when an endowment is the fundamental, one of the principal sources of revenue, would lead to lower endowment funding levels. We don't think that's likely. It would happen, though, and we saw that happen with private universities during the financial crisis. However, I think what's relevant is not that would happen. What's relevant is to compare that to what would happen under our current system, which is the state funding us. We know the state isn't flush with cash in an economic downturn either. The likelihood that we would do better in a financial downturn than we would with state funding, I think, is a reasonable. It's a reasonably high likelihood that we would do better with the endowment model, even if it was having trouble in the markets, just because the state's in the same position they find themselves now, which is that you don't have a lot of money either. So I guess I'm here to represent the members of the committee of the Senate Budget Committee. The Senate Budget Committee did believe very firmly that this was a good plan and a plan that would move the University of Oregon forward. And thank you for your time and interest in this topic.
Thank you, Representative Lindsay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you clarify a little bit more on, if I understood you correctly, you said you went under this model that there's a possibility that endowment funds, or I guess the donations would go down. Could you tease that out a little bit better?
Yes, sorry, I was unclear. So all I was saying is, if we have, suppose the stock market crashes, okay, we have a financial crisis like we had. If we are sustaining ourselves on endowment funds to some degree, obviously tuition will still be a source of funding. I think the relevant question to ask is, are we still able to predict our funding levels from our endowment in that situation? And I think the answer is yes. We're better able to predict our funding levels from that endowment than we are to predict our funding levels from the state government.
Okay. Representative Denbrough.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions, just first to follow up on that one. So, you know, under the current system, if we have an economic downturn and the state gives less money to the university can raise tuition. We don't want that to happen, but it can happen. If we, you know, if the university were so heavily reliant on the endowment and its performance, you know, in the stock market or other investments, and at the same time bound by the 5% limit on tuition, how would the university cope in a way that wouldn't hurt students in other ways in terms of, you know, having to close down classes and cut operations, et cetera?
My understanding of the 5% cap is that cap is it applies to the ability of the local board to raise tuition. However, in an emergency situation, tuition can be raised more than 5% by seeking the approval of the legislature.
Great.
So I think that would be how you would work with that problem.
Great, thank you. My other question, this is to whoever wants to pick it up, you know, addresses the issue of the local board. And this is something we're going to be working on a lot, you know, over the next year or so, just, you know, looking at local boards, advantages, disadvantages, et cetera. From your perspective right now, what would a local board bring to the university that you don't already have through your academic council, through your local support groups, your work with the, you know, I assume the president has a cabinet, you know, et cetera. What would the local board bring that you need?
I think it would bring the ability to set policies that are tailored to the needs of the institution. I don't think they would, even though they would have the theoretical responsibility of approving new curriculum, new programs, majors, etc., they would generally be expected to defer to the academic council, to the other internal institutions of shared government governance. What they can do, let me give you an example. A friend of mine in the anthropology department went last year on a research trip. He studies human nutrition, and had to go to Siberia in December to do research. And if you're a state employee, there are lots of forms to fill out, and of course it's very unusual for a state employee to go to Siberia in December, unless you're a professor and that's your job. So a board could craft a policy on that and anything else that would be tailored to the needs of a major research university, cut a lot of bureaucratic red tape, relieve the administration of having to hire a bunch of people to process that red tape, and make the institution run a lot more smoothly.
Mm-hmm. But again, if I could follow up, presumably we will pass Senate Bill 242, which is going to move the university from state agency status. Universities will have more autonomy in that, at least under the State Board of Higher Education, under the current system. Presumably, the State Board of Higher Education is going to write academic policy or policy that would address that really would be more tailored for the universities in general. So I guess my question would be, you know, to what extent is U of O academic policy, you know, really unique, you know, as opposed to policy that would be crafted for OSU or the other universities?
I guess I draw an analogy to, you know, we have different coaches for different teams, and we have seven institutions in the state that have very different objective functions. Some of them are, you know, Eastern Oregon has a very different objective function than Oregon State. Oregon State has an engineering school, or University of Oregon does not. We serve a different demographic of students, different students with different interests. Our students get jobs at different places. We raise money from different types of donors. We raise different kinds of research funds. Those are all unique elements, really, to each of those campuses. And I think an individual board or a local board is really critical to having the football coach coach the football team and the baseball coach the baseball team. And I think that's what that local board is able to do. I think the other thing, which I think is just important to recognize, and Ian mentioned this in his testimony, is that this is how many of the finest institutions in our country run their institutions. They have a local governing board. And I think that speaks volumes about the efficacy of that method.
And one last point. So I would assume on a scale of 1 to 10, getting U of O financial stability is pretty high up, you know, close to 10, you know, in your desires, given past history. How high would having a local board be?
I think for me, the administration already does an excellent job of buffering us against the bureaucracy that comes from Salem. And I say that with all due
respect. We resemble that remark. Thank you.
I say that with all due respect for the very legitimate interest that the state board has and that the legislature has. But we compete with other universities, and what makes us excel is our ability to compete with other universities. And as I said, I came here from the East Coast, and I was happy to do so because, from my perspective, there's very little, you know, red tape I have to contend with. I would say, you know, this is primarily about the financing stability. That's a 10. This is about the students. This is about giving students a chance at the American dream. That's the most important. If we have to, you know, put up with red tape to get to that goal, then so be it. But I think we can be even more effective, say, 6 or 7, if we can have the board as well.
Great, thank you. And I would say that there is a, you know, an added benefit to having a local board. I will throw out that Yem mentioned, and that's that it can bring in a sort of outside perspective, you know, kind of a, you know, the world of people who are going to be hiring graduates and, you know, who are coming from a, you know, diverse range of areas in the state, that there can be some merit, you know, to having that kind of sounding board.
And I guess I might differ with Ian a little bit in that I actually believe that governance structure is really part and parcel of the financial stability. I think that eagle-eye focus on that institution and making it achieve the goals that have been set out for it would be a very important part of achieving the kind of financial stability that's possible.
I think Rep. Dembrough is saying that he thinks a local board could help you all with one foot in reality instead of too much hypothetical thinking, as sometimes can happen in institutions.
There are multiple realities in the world.
Multiple dimensions, right. Well, I appreciate hearing, I think, the level of involvement and scrutiny also that the faculty has been able to provide in these proposals. That encourages me to hear that you guys have been, kind of been given free rein to give it a once-over, if you will, and to really look those proposals over. As we go forward, and we obviously don't have time to get into it today, but I think the whole concept of the endowment and the performance of that endowment obviously is a key component of this going forward, you know, and obviously in this state, when we talk about assumed rates of return or guaranteed rates of return, and you talk about things like PERS, it can get you an interesting response amongst Oregonians. So to all we can do to, you know, assuage those fears and so forth, I think is going to be helpful. But perhaps, you know, I could have a extended conversation with some or all of you at another time about that. I'd like to learn more about that. So with that, we need to get into our next panel. And last but not least, we have our students tonight here today, and we have Emma Calloway and Tyler Hogan.
Great. Thank you all for sticking around. We think this is an incredibly important conversation, and we're happy to participate, and we intend to continue to participate as we move forward throughout this session and many more sessions to come, and we'll still be debating, I think, these topics. So Tyler Hogan is here from the Oregon Student Association and our board of directors, so he is the voice of the Oregon Student Association. I'd like him to speak, and then we'd be happy to take any questions, and of course, with limited time today, we're also happy to take questions offline as well. So.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembro, and members of the committee, thank you, first of all, for allowing students to be here to speak and testify today. As Emma just said, my name is Tyler Hogan, and I'm a student at Oregon State University. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the Oregon Student Association. As you probably know, OSA represents over 100,000 students statewide. And we have voted unanimously to oppose Senate Bill 559 and Senate Joint Resolution 20. This bill has not moved out of the Senate Education Committee, but other forms of this bill will undoubtedly come before the legislature this session and in future sessions. I would like to speak about our overarching concerns. First, we oppose Senate Bill 559 because we believe in an affordable, accessible, quality public education in Oregon. Oregon taxpayers have spent a lot of money to make the U of O the great university that it is today, and we need to make sure that this institution remains accessible to Oregonians first and foremost. Students across the state appreciate the commitment President LaRiviere made to keeping tuition increases at 5% every year if Senate Bill 559 were to pass. But what is still lacking in the bill is a commitment to how many Oregonians the U of O plans to educate in the coming years. Without accountability through funding from the Oregon legislature or the Oregon university system, there are few pressures to continue educating large numbers of Oregonians. It would be possible to keep tuition increases below 5% if U of O is only educating 25% in-state students each year. Unfortunately, U of O has an undeniable trend of bringing in more and more out-of-state students, with 48% of out-of-state students in their 2010 freshman class. 51% in-state students is just not enough.
Oh, I'm sorry, you need to introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I did in the
Emma
beginning.
Did, I think.
That doesn't count?
No, apparently not.
Oh, all right. I'm Tyler Hogan, and I'm
perfect.
Oregon State
Thank
University.
You very much. Thank I'm you. Sorry.
So we agree that there is a need to change the post-secondary education system in Oregon, but removing the U of O from participating in the Oregon university system removes their involvement in collaborating to achieve Oregon's 40-40-20 goals. As an example, there are OARs that OUS holds in regards to the ease of transferring between institutions that our private and separated universities don't have to abide by. Transfer students are referenced briefly in the performance compact with the state, but OSA represents students in community colleges and universities, and this performance compact is not specific enough to ease the concerns of the ever-increasing number of transfer students. Next, U of O has not demonstrated why they believe a local board will improve their outcomes. Instead, we have heard a lot about how it eases fundraising efforts and governance decisions. Adopting institutional board governance where it has not existed before demands extreme care and clear articulation of roles. For example, Florida Governor Jeb Bush dissolved its state board of regents in early 2000 and created institutional boards of trustees at 11 universities. Then, a few years later, former Senator Bob Graham pushed for a constitutional amendment creating a state-level board of governors. Since then, the state board, the institutional boards, and the state legislature have been embroiled in lawsuits and conflicts over distribution of authority, especially tuition-setting authority. Shifting to institutional governance in Oregon, without careful consideration of all options, discussion, and buy-in by all stakeholders and the public, is likely to result in conflict and chaos that consumes time, energy, and taxpayers' money. In reference to SJR 20, we greatly appreciate any ideas that will bring in more donor dollars into our struggling system. But we have heard from the state treasurer that our bonding capacity this biennium is slim. We are also concerned that large endowments are a big risk. The UO Foundation has done well with their endowment recently, and they've been lucky. The average endowment is down 25% from 3 years ago. This means if U of O had received their bonding request in 07, they could have lost upwards of $250 million of the public's money. And we don't say this to be inflammatory. We bring this to you because we know if the state had to fill in loss of funds, other universities may have suffered, universities like my own. We believe in the statewide system that keeps everyone afloat and striving for excellence in Oregon. We also believe in the right for students to have a strong role in the shared governance of our institutions. OSA has a good relationship with OUS and the State Board of Higher Education. We play a key role in the process, something that was frankly an afterthought during the development of Senate Bill 559. We prefer working with a centralized body rather than breaking up the system piece by piece and eroding the shared power of student voices. We deserve to have the U of O as a public university, the state's university, and the university that people everywhere in Oregon can call their own and be proud of. Even as an OSU student who loves the rivalry and dislikes the Ducks football team more than most, I can respect and relate to that type of university. As an Oregonian, this is my university too, even though I prefer OSU. U of O and OSU are Oregon schools, and they need to stay that way. In conclusion, we are concerned with the limited accountability this proposal has to Oregonians. We appreciate the tuition increase cap that was proposed, but want an improved commitment to educating Oregonians. We think a centralized government allows for a cost-sharing and collective commitment to statewide goals. We know a change of this magnitude is risky, and endowment with this level of public dollars is not worth the gamble when we are starving for dollars to fund the Oregon Opportunity, a fund that allows Oregonians to choose from any one of our institutions. Students have had more of a voice as part of Senate Bill 242 and other governance models than we had during any phase of the development of Senate Bill 559 and SJI 20. Please hear our concerns and consider them as we move forward with these important conversations about University of Oregon during this session and many more to come. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Tyler. Appreciate your comments. And I would anticipate there's going to be a lot of opportunity for you to remain engaged in the process as we go forward from here. We appreciate your ideas, your thoughts, your passion, all of that.
Thank you.
And it goes for Emma, of course, and the whole staff. You guys do a great job. Any comments?
Sure. Thank you. You know, I just want to say that, you know, this subcommittee passed out a bill that is going to be creating the process for creating the performance metrics that the different universities and the community colleges are going to be committing to over, well, we hope the process will be finished in time for the 2012 session. That's the goal. And, you know, we really look forward to, you know, taking the work that's been done by the, you know, the various faculty senates and the different institutions, as well as OUS, and I know the community colleges have been doing some work with this. It's setting those performance metrics and being able to create them so that, you know, going back to, you know, Professor McNeely's comments, so that they're not levers that are blunt and, you know, don't really reflect the reality of the universities and the goals that we want for them, but that really respect the diversities of the missions, et cetera. It's going to be a lot of work, and it's going to take all of us, you know, working together to make that happen. But that really is at the core of what we do, whatever direction we end up going in. You know, we have to decide, what is it we want from our university system? What is it we want from our community colleges? What do we want from the entire panoply of post-secondary education in the state? And then how do we make sure that it gets the support that it needs to be effective? So I look forward to work. I think the rest of us look forward to working with all of you on that.
Well, thank you, and thanks to all of you that provided testimony today and shared your vision with us. It's been a helpful time, instructive time, and with that, we will conclude our informational hearing, and we will conclude our meeting for today.